Until the 1960s, discriminatory laws and lending practices forced nearly all African Americans to live in a single neighborhood north of downtown Milwaukee. According to the Wisconsin Historical Society, almost all of Milwaukee's subdivisions had been planned with covenants that forbid the sale of property to people of color. There were informal agreements in real estate among lenders and landlords who worked to enforce these restrictions. These practices were considered legal, totally above board, until 1968. We'll pick up the story here on Milwaukee's 200 nights of marches demanding a fair housing law. Kristen Luffelman is a field services representative at the Wisconsin Historical Society and contributed to a traveling exhibit on the housing marches. Kristen, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. So can you explain for people who do not know what the Milwaukee Fair housing marches were, can you acquaint us with this history?
Absolutely. Well, as you mentioned, for decades, African Americans had faced housing discrimination in Milwaukee. Probably a lot of your listeners, if they live in homes in the Milwaukee area that are older than the 1960s, they can look at the deeds of their homes and see that there are racially restrictive covenants in there. So given that landscape, in 1962, Alderwoman Val Phillips introduced the first fair housing bill into the Common Council. She was the first woman and the first person of color to hold a Common Council seat. All the other folks on the council were men. And the first time she introduced it, it was rejected 18-1. So over the next 6 years, she tried to pass the bill three more times with the same result. And at the same time, of course, you have civil rights movements across the country. In Milwaukee, since the 1960s, the NAACP Youth Council had been organizing direct action, so demonstrations against segregation in Milwaukee. For instance, they protested against Mark's Big Boy for employment discrimination, the Eagles Club for having an all-white membership. And they met with their advisor, Father James Grappi, who was a Catholic priest at St. Boniface in the Inner Core in Milwaukee, and took on the cause of fair housing. So the marches themselves started just over 50 years ago, and a lot happened in the first 3 days of the marches. The first day of marching was August 28th, 1967, and over 200 members of the Youth Council and the public, led by Father Grappi, marched over the 16th Street Bridge in Milwaukee from the north side to the predominantly white south side. That first night, they were met with 5,000 counter-protesters, but they kept going. The second night, they did the same march, and that night they were met by 13,000 counter-protesters.
Wow.
So these people are throwing rocks, bottles, racial epithets, and by the time the marchers returned back to their headquarters, they returned to see that it was on fire.
This is the Freedom House you're talking about?
It is, yeah.
What were the most important events, the milestones during these 200 nights of marching? This is a lot of commitment by people to go out there night after night and risk their life.
Risk their life and arrest as well. Many of them were arrested. On August 30th, this is just the third night of marching, Mayor Henry Mayer issued a curfew. He said that there couldn't be any marching between 4 p.m. and the morning hours. And wanting to comply with the law, the NAACP Youth Council met at St. Boniface in the Freedom House to have a rally instead of marching. But even with that, the police deemed it an unlawful gathering of people. And so 58 people were arrested. So the next night, they decided, well, if we're going to be arrested for not marching, we might as well be arrested for marching. So they kept going, and as you said, it was 200 consecutive nights of marching. That includes through the winter. We all know what a Wisconsin winter is like. And they kept going until March 4th, 1968. So that's their 200th night of marching. And I think when they reached that point, they knew that there were discussions about a federal fair housing bill and decided the 209th was a real statement.
Kristen Luffelman is with us. She is field services representative for the Wisconsin Historical Society. She helped create the Historical Society's traveling exhibit called Crossing the Line about the fair housing marches. We're looking back 50 years. Do you remember these marches? Did the national housing law help in Milwaukee? Do you think Milwaukee has changed when it comes to housing equality? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Kristen, looking back at the pictures, at your exhibit, and what the Historical Society has compiled, it seems as though the marchers would also try to conceal their faces because they were concerned that if they showed who they were, they would be at the risk of being arrested, at the risk of being targeted by police.
That's true. And people were also worried about losing their jobs. Certainly some people who participated in the marchers did lose their jobs. But most of the NAACP Youth Council commandos, who were a protective force for the Youth Council members, were arrested at some point. Father Grappi was arrested. Val Phillips was arrested. So as much as they may have tried to hide their faces, I think that the police knew who they were and were certainly out there for them.
The protests, they did get national media attention, and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. expressed his support for the marches at one point. Can you put this into the national context, the Milwaukee housing marches, in the national civil rights movement for us?
Absolutely. I think when most of us learn about the civil rights movement, we learn about it as a Southern movement. So we hear about events like the Birmingham protest and the Selma to Montgomery march, which resulted in, of course, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. But the movement didn't stop there. In Milwaukee, we have a third really important piece of that puzzle that changed the national landscape. And the Fair Housing Act, which is passed in April of 1968, is really the final great legislative achievement of the civil rights era.
How did the 1968 Federal Fair Housing Act, what implications did that have on Milwaukee and how it went forward in housing?
Well, that act prohibits discrimination concerning the sale, rental, and financing of housing based on race, religion, national origin, or gender. And, of course, we've since added other protected classes to that. In Milwaukee, it was now possible for African Americans and other people of color to live wherever they wanted to live legally. Of course, sometimes it's easier to change laws than it is to change minds. So as neighborhoods in Milwaukee opened up to African Americans, in our case, we saw thousands of white residents leaving the city, which really perpetuated the problem of segregation even after it was illegal.
Oh, so it was more of like this white flight.
Exactly, exactly.
Why did the marches end when they did?
Well, as I mentioned, that 200 nights is really a statement. And so the NAACP Youth Council felt that that had made a real impact. At the same time, the federal government was considering a federal Fair Housing Act. And what really brought it to the forefront was on April 4th, 1968, of course, that's when Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. And so at that point, the federal government, having seen that, having seen demonstrations in Milwaukee, in Chicago, in other northern cities, they pushed the Fair Housing Bill forward. So this is just mere weeks after our youth council finished marching. And then a couple of weeks after that, Milwaukee passed, finally, Val Phillips' bill, which was actually more comprehensive than the federal bill.
Well, Kristen, thank you so much for joining us and sharing this history with us.
Thank you for having me.
Kristen Leffelman is Field Services Representative for the Wisconsin Historical Society. She helped create the Historical Society's traveling exhibit. It's called Crossing the Line. It's about the Fair Housing Marches. Do you remember the Fair Housing Marches? Did the National Housing Law help in Milwaukee? Do you think Milwaukee has changed when it comes to housing equality? You can join in this conversation at 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll return after a news update here on the Ideas Network. In 1962, 5 years before the Fair Housing Marches began, Milwaukee Alderwoman Vel Phillips introduced the first fair housing ordinance in the Milwaukee Common Council. The ordinance was defeated 18-1, her vote being the only one in favor. Phillips was the first African-American and the first woman elected to the council. Every other member was a white man. Over the next few years, Phillips would reintroduce her ordinance several times until it finally passed in 1968. Here she is speaking to the council in 1967.
There are no longer excuses for inaction or delay. Those people who come every day to St. Boniface Church, and they come from all over the country, come there with the idea that nobody is free until everybody is free, and we intend to march, all of us, until we get just some of the basic freedoms that are ours. If ever a matter.
And we are looking back at the fair housing marches and fair housing legislation in Milwaukee that occurred 50 years ago on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. What has changed in the city for African-American homeowners and renters? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Prentice McKinney was an NAACP Youth Council commando during the Milwaukee Fair Housing Marches. He owns Savoy's Bar in Milwaukee and remains politically active today. Prentice, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, when you hear Vel Phillips there speaking before the Common Council, what comes to mind?
Well, it's deja vu. It's a reminder of my youth and my first involvement, actually, in civil rights.
What was that like when you started to get involved with the NAACP?
Well, let me give you the reason I got involved first. I had a brother who was in the Army, and during that period of time, of course, there was the draft, so you didn't have a choice about whether or not you were going to go to service. I also had a brother who was in the Air Force. My brother, who was in the Air Force, came home on furlough and was going to buy my mother a home. And so we went out house shopping. Remember, we went to the corner of 24th and Capitol, and there was a home for sale. Sign outside, house for sale. So we decided we wanted to take a look at it. Now my brother was in uniform. And so we walked up, knocked on the door, and lady came to the door, white lady came to the door, and asked, you know, what we wanted, and we told her we saw the sign, and we just wanted to take a look through the property to see if we were interested in buying it. And I will never forget her response. It was, oh, my God, we couldn't sell to black people. Our neighbors would be upset with us. Well, she didn't use the black people word. She used the N-word, and I found it offensive that someone would speak to my mother using that term. And so there was a little scuffle between me and my brother as he drugged me off the porch. So, I mean, that was my initial reaction, was why would you treat us this way because of the color of our skin? A short time later, the NAACP Youth Council moved their Freedom House over to 15th and just a little south of Elite Street. And I lived on 14th. And so we happened to encounter each other, me and some of my friends and the commandos, and we ended up actually becoming involved. And that was the inspiration for me, was I was next in terms of being drafted. I had two brothers in service, and yet my mother could not buy a house where she wanted to live because she was black.
What was your role as a commando during the marches? What did the NAACP commandos do?
Well, primarily we did two things. One, we strategized with Father Grappi as to how we would approach a march, where we would be going. And this is during the period in which we're marching on aldermen's homes until we finally get to the 16th Street Bridge. And so we would strategize on how to bring attention, bring focus to what we were complaining about. The second was, during the marches, our responsibility was to ensure the safety of the marchers. And so if there were counter demonstrators, we had to stand in between them and the marchers. If it was even an assault by the police, and that happened on occasions, our responsibilities was to stand in between those officers and those marchers. And in many cases, we were arrested, taken to jail. You know, when people today talk about being involved in civil rights, I always ask to see their jail record, because even Martin Luther King went to jail fighting for civil rights. And so that was part of what you expected, the hostility, the anger, and jail.
The Freedom House was near where you grew up, I understand. Mm-hmm. What happened at the Freedom House, and how important was it for organizing?
Well, the Freedom House was essentially central to our daily operations. I mean, we all went there on a regular basis. We rallied at St. Boniface Church, but the Freedom House was the place where we actually got together and strategized. What happened was, at the end of a march, we were returning to the Freedom House and exiting the bus and going into the house, and all of a sudden there were like police all over everywhere, and they were screaming, "Stay in the house, stay in the house, don't come out." And then suddenly someone threw tear gas into the house. Well, obviously you can't stay in the house with tear gas, and so we came running out of the house. The police alleged that there was a sniper. There was never anything to indicate that that was actually the case. The house caught on fire as a result of the ignition from the tear gas.
And that's August of 1967. These marches continue, though, without the Freedom House. But how did that change after it burned down? Did that add more fuel to the fire, so to say, to these marches?
Well, sure. I mean, any incident that would happen to us would actually inflame more people, because they felt it just wasn't right that we couldn't even march across the bridge, let alone not be able to live anywhere but in the segregated slums of the city. And so any incidents that were reported simply added to the number of people who were offended by it, and therefore helped us in terms of recruitment.
Explain the significance of this bridge that divided people of color with white people.
Well, actually, I guess the city fathers decided that that would be the boundary in terms of where African Americans could live, socialize, or whatever. And so on one side of the bridge, the southern side, you had predominantly Polish and other mixtures of white people. And on the north side, you had the African-American community. Now, many in our community understood that it would not be in your best interest to be found on the South Side after dark. And so that became to us essentially the Mason-Dixon line. And in our fight for integration, of course, we had to cross the Mason-Dixon line.
Before we continue on in the conversation, I want to remind listeners that we're talking with Prentice McKinney. He was an NAACP Youth Council Commando during the Fair Housing Marches, and we're welcoming your memories as well at 800-642-1234. What do you recall from the housing marches? Were you there? Do you work in real estate in Milwaukee? Do you think neighborhoods are more integrated today? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Prentice, before we go further in the conversation, let's turn back now to your mother's story of finding a home to buy. Mm-hmm. How did this end up?
Well, it didn't end up good. My brother went back to service, and eventually, he bought her a home. I think it was probably 4 or 5 years later. He was stationed in Europe and was trying to decide whether or not he wanted to remain in service as a career. So I guess you could say it ended up well that in the end, Mom ended up with a home. But it was the fact that she was stopped initially. I mean, you have two of your sons who are in service. And at that point, this country was at war in Vietnam, and yet they could not even buy their mother a home outside of the ghetto. And then there was a third son, me. And they intended to draft me. So it was a reason to fight.
During the time the marches were happening, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, of course, was covering all of this, published an article about you where they described you as, quote, one of the angriest of Milwaukee's angry young Negroes. Do you remember this article, and how did it make you feel?
I do, and actually it validated me. Angry I was then, I still am now. Anyone who believes that this world is an unjust and desires to change that is angry about it. I mean, you look today and you've got what? Hashtag Me Too. I mean, women are angry, I think would be a good description of that in terms of what is happening to them and what has historically been their experience. And I think that to some degree, righteous indignation is required of those who want to bring about social change.
Help us recall the role Father James Groppi played in all of this. What do you think drove him to be so involved in this struggle? And what role did he have?
Well, Grop was Italian and had faced discrimination growing up. Obviously, as a Catholic priest, he was motivated by morality. I remember many of his speeches in which he said, if something happens to a parishioner of mine, it becomes a problem for me. I think on one level, he was, how do I say this, overemphasized. I think the city, in its efforts to destroy the movement, had to identify someone as being the agitator. And so that's what they did with Grop. The press focused in on him, the mayor and Chief Breyer essentially labeled him as the agitator, and therefore there was a vendetta against him. I think Grop's role in terms of the marchers was almost a second father kind of situation. He cared very deeply about the people who he marched with. He would do many things to help. Some of us even continue our education. And so on one hand, you have Grop, who is depicted with the horns in his head as outside or an agitator. And on the other hand, in the community that he worked and where people knew him, He was a very loving and passionate person, and stood for or stood with those who wanted to fight for justice in our community.
Do you remember vividly the last night of marching, the last night you marched, and can you take us there?
I don't remember vividly. That was 50 years ago. But I do kind of remember that waning period towards the end of the march. We had decided that we were going to march until, and as Grop would say, until hell froze over, if need be, to bring about changes. And so the march actually evolved. More and more people joined, and towards the end, I mean, we were like, I don't know, I'd say extended family, and moved from marching for open housing to marching against discrimination and welfare. So it wasn't that there was like an abrupt end and no one participated in any other social movements beyond that point in time.
What happened after the 1968 open housing law was passed? Did you see changes in Milwaukee?
Well, I mean, over time, those who could afford to move out of the central city did. And so you started to notice small pockets of residents establishing themselves in predominantly white communities. Places like Sherman Park developed, where there was mixed populations living together. But overall, I mean, 50 years ago, Milwaukee was one of the most segregated cities in country. Today, it remains one of the most segregated cities in the country. I remember Grop saying a long time ago, sorry, I refer to Father Grop, he has Grop, we all did. It's an affectionate term. But I remember Grop and the mayor having disputes over whether or not the segregation was caused by the city or by the suburbs. And it was always Mayor Myers' contention that fair housing needed to occur in the suburbs first before we could expect it here in the city.
Prentice McKinney, when you look back at the Milwaukee Fair Housing marches and then you look at today, what do you think we should learn from them? What should we take away and use in our life today?
There's a topic I talk about occasionally, and it's called When Good People Do Nothing. In order for evil to prevail, it simply requires that good people do nothing. The lessons from the past should be, unless you become active about your concerns, you will remain a passive person and your concerns will never be addressed. In order for Donald Trump, for instance, to prevail, the good people of this country, if they just sit back, Donald Trump will have his way. And so it requires a level of righteous indignation to say what you're doing to our country and to our people. It's not right nor fair, and to become involved in incidents, including direct action.
Prentice McKinney is with us. He was an NAACP Youth Council Commando during the Fair Housing Marches about 50 years ago in Milwaukee. Your memories are welcome at 800-642-1234. What do you remember from the housing marches? Were you there? Did you march? Do you work in real estate in Milwaukee today? Do you think neighborhoods are more integrated? 800-642-1234. We'll return after a news update. We're talking about the Milwaukee Fair Housing Marches 50 years later on this Hour of the Morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In 1967 and 1968, the city's NAACP Youth Council picketed the homes of elders and marched for 200 consecutive nights to demand a fair housing law. Here is Father James Groppi, one of the leaders of the marches, talking to a reporter on the second night of the marches after the Freedom House was burned in August of 1967. The Freedom House was the NAACP meeting quarters. Let's take a listen.
Well, Father, has your marches to the South Side accomplished anything so far for fair housing?
We're going to get fair housing not only for the city of Milwaukee, but we're going to get it on a national scene. And it's going to be this consistent type of courageous protest that's going to bring about fair housing legislation. Frederick Douglass talked about this 100 years ago. He said no one ever got their rights given to them on a platter. You've got to fight for it. You've got to struggle for it. And that's what we're doing. We're protesting. And we're going to keep agitating. We're going to keep protesting until we get what is ours.
Now, a group of Milwaukeeans have come together with an initiative called 200 Nights of Freedom to commemorate Father Groppi and other marchers. Adam Carr is one of the organizers of the 200 Nights of Freedom and March on Milwaukee 50th. Adam, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Well, can you tell us what is the effort behind the formation of this group?
Absolutely. We started almost exactly 2 years ago, and really a small group of community members called together other Milwaukeeans to say what's possible for the 50th anniversary of the open housing marches. As that room of people grew and we heard more and more input from people, what we found is that people were inspired by the open housing marches, the 200 nights of marching, in so many different directions. And I think what it kind of came back to a lot of times was people asking, what's the fair housing of our day? If that was such a motivating, inspiring catalyst 50 years ago, what can we use in our contemporary times to get people fired up? And there was a lot of passion in that conversation. People would say black male incarceration is the fair housing of our day. Disparity, education, unemployment, youth feeling disenfranchised. So are the fair housing of our day. In fact, fair housing is still an issue in our city. And then in the midst of our planning, as we kept going, Sherman Park happened. Mm. Protests for Dontre Hamilton were happening. And I think in a lot of ways, what we saw in our contemporary moment was almost a spooky reflection of the conditions that led to the open housing marches 50 years ago, a summer of unrest, a feeling in the winds and feeling in our national tone, a need for change. And so what we eventually found as kind of our focal point, knowing that there were many different directions, there's no shortage of entrenched dysfunction in Milwaukee and problems, were we wanted to be able to create a prompt around the open housing marches that was inclusive and that recognized the fact there's a lot of people doing incredible work and activism around the city of Milwaukee. So our two big themes were recognition and reignition, knowing that simply a lot of people around Milwaukee don't know the story of the open housing marches. Prentice alluded to earlier the fact that oftentimes people's knowledge of the open housing marches will begin and end with the name Father Groppi. And Father Groppi, as Prentice also alluded to, was an incredible man. But the NAACP Youth Council and Commandos were incredible contributors to this story. In fact, were probably primary authors, or at least one of the primary authors of the story. And your average person walking down the street in Milwaukee won't know too much about those folks. Go ahead.
I'm going to pause right here to take a call. Let's go to John in Green Bay, who was a marcher. John, go ahead.
Well, good morning. I was a marcher. I had made the walk from Selma to Montgomery sometime before, and I was captured by the concepts that Father Groppi offered. And so on a regular basis, I was a teacher here. The students would join me, and we would go down to St. Boniface. But my students, all of whom were white, discovered that in a black church, Jesus was a black man. Quite a remarkable discovery for all of us. Anyway, we marched, and we won, but then we didn't win, because it didn't take interested parties long to discover ways of continuing to discriminate. I moved to Green Bay, but in 1973, I purchased a house here and found in the title to my land that this property may not be sold to blacks. And it was all over at that time. And so we did a little work here in Green Bay. We went house to house and asked people to sign a petition supporting open housing in Green Bay. And it didn't take 200 days, but our city council did pass a non-exempt open housing ordinance. We feel very good about that.
John, thank you so much for calling in with this story. Prentice, your reaction.
I'd like to say thank you, John. Thank you from the minority community and from our hearts for standing up with us and then extending that even into new communities. So thank you, John.
And Adam, is this the type of work that you're trying to see get done through your group?
Absolutely, I think. So Reignition is kind of our other big idea, and the story of the Open Housing March is, doesn't have power just as something in history at arm's length. Seeing who and how it happened, the tactics they used, the incredible resolve and courage of those marchers is something that we saw could inspire people in present-day Milwaukee, in particular because a lot of folks didn't know that story. A lot of young black and brown youth Milwaukee have never been offered the story of the commandos, of the youth council. So we took all of this energy that we knew was possible from this story as a platform, as a prompt, and we formed March on Milwaukee 50th, which is sort of our organizing group, and then came up with an idea to try to be as audacious as the marchers were 50 years ago and have an initiative for a long period of time, 200 Nights of Freedom, taking direct inspiration from the timeline, and that period being an initiative where community members were inspired by the marches. They created events, they created programming, they created educational resources that kicked off on August 28th here in City Hall, Milwaukee. And we've seen over 100 different kinds of events since then. And we've seen, you got to go to our website, 200nightsoffreedom.org, just to see there's been this incredible kaleidoscope of how people were inspired by the open housing marches. And we've seen an incredible depth and breadth of events.
Let's bring in Joe now, who joins us from Hartford. Hi, Joe.
Yeah, hi. Well, I was just given a call because I just had this memory. I was a 10-year-old boy in Milwaukee growing up east of Capitol Court, north of Sherman Park. And the house that I grew up in was built in 1947. Now, at 10 years old, I had no clue about that. But we moved in like 1973 out to Germantown. And later on, I look at the title of our old house, that house on 42nd north of Capitol. And in it, it says something like, I don't have it here, but it does say, just like the man in Green Bay reported, it said not to be sold to colored people. And now I'm an adult later on realizing that. And you hear, and I grew up, you know, nearby in that city, in Milwaukee. I love Milwaukee, but this, it's all real. And what McKinney did and others and Grappi, they were just local heroes and making change. And Phillips and the, you know, I was too young to really be involved in that, but as an adult, that impacted me, that I grew up in a house where McKinney's mother could have walked up to our door and perhaps we would have not been able to sell the house to them. And that's just in modern day cities and in our country, it's real. And you know, we're all alive to still experience this. But I just wanted to report kind of what I learned after growing up in the city.
Prentice McKinney, go ahead.
Well, I'd just like to say that I'd like people to look at the fact that this country at that point in time required service in the military. You were going to be drafted into the service at age 18. And at the same time, you were denied the rights of an everyday citizen to live where you wanted to live. How just is that?
Let's bring in Kirsten now from Milwaukee with an observation. Kirsten, go ahead. Hi, Kirsten, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead.
So I've lived and grown up in Milwaukee for 35 years now. And first off, it's great to put a voice with a face. And when I went to UW-Milwaukee, I had a history of methods of historical research. And in that, we actually studied the marches, and we talked about Prentice a lot. So I'm glad to finally hear him speaking. But I work as a case manager for, it's actually an agency that works with Milwaukee County, where we go and do visits with people who have mental illnesses. Now, Milwaukee is so still segregated that when I look at an address, I can know what race that individual is basically going to be. If it turns out that they're not, I'm shocked because it is that segregated in Milwaukee and still is, and it doesn't seem like anything has changed.
Kirsten, thank you for calling in. And as we start to wrap up here, Adam and Prentice, as members of different generations who are working together on the same issues, what can your generations learn from one another, and what have you learned from each other? Adam, I'm going to have to start with you here.
For sure. I think, I mean, something from the story I think every listener should be aware of, I had no idea that was true about the open housing marches. On the second night of marching, when a group of 400, 500 marchers came from the north side to the south side, they were met by 13,000 angry counter-protesters. These were white folks standing on the south side of Milwaukee. So that's 13,000. At that point in our city, as disgraceful as it is, that was probably the largest demonstration ever in our city. That was soon overshadowed by demonstrations led by the Youth Council and Commandos. But if we want to know, oftentimes that we feel like we're groping in the dark trying to understand why is Milwaukee the way it is, you can look at the open housing marches. You can look at the vehemence of the hatred of and the depth of the fear of white folks living in that time. And frankly, I don't think you have to connect too many dots to get where we are today.
Prentice, I'll let you have the last few words here in the last few seconds.
Thank you. As we had issues 50 years ago, today there are similar issues of racial discrimination in this country, perpetuated essentially by our current president. Unless the lessons from the past are that in order to bring about change, people must become involved. If they do not, evil will always prevail.
Prentice and Adam, thank you both so much. That was Prentice McKinney, who was an NAACP Youth Council Commando during the Fair Housing Marches of 1967 to 1968, and Adam Carr, who helped organize 200 Nights of Freedom and March on Milwaukee 50th. Earlier, we spoke with Kirsten Luffelman, Field Services Representative at the Wisconsin Historical Society. This hour was produced by Colleen Leahy. Brittany Williams provided technical direction. Michelle Johnson is Executive Producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the Ideas Network.